Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thank you for joining us. Can we talk? I mean, is it possible still to talk politics and keep it civil, respectful? In this day and age, it might surprise you to hear that, yes, we can. For the latest in our series, You're Polarized, I'm Polarized, The Way to a Shared American Future, Carolyn DuPont gives us a demonstration.
We've all found ourselves unable to talk with people on the opposite side of the political divide. These conversations often end in argument, acrimony, and a feeling of alienation rather than in the sense of connection that we all seek. What if we approach these conversations differently, with genuine curiosity? After all, there is a human being behind those political opinions. Understanding how they see the world might help us expand our own grasp of the problems that plague us. It might help us reframe issues in more knowledgeable and more accurate ways. What if, out of that genuine curiosity, we listened without seeking to change our conversation partner? That's exactly what we're going to do today in this segment. I'm joined in the studio today by David Burt, a Republican, and Ed Bryson, a Democrat. Both live in Nicholasville, Kentucky. David and Ed, thank you for being willing to have this brave conversation. So I want to begin by asking each of you to explain how you identify yourself politically, however you want to say it, red or blue, what that means to you, and what values and priorities inform your political identity and choices. And David, let's just start with you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I generally identify as red, but I like to think of myself as a reasoned thinker, so neither party really represents my worldview very well. I find that the excesses of the parties seem to be ever-growing, so I think of myself as a conservative, but not necessarily a Republican. But the issues that motivate me include personal responsibility and freedom. You know, our lives are full of choices, and what we do with them has a huge impact on our entire reality. So I reject group identity politics as dehumanizing, because when we do that, we reduce somebody to their race or sex, and we discount their body of work, their values, and their actual essence as a person. Second would be free markets. I'm definitely a market guy. Third is human dignity. And by that, I'm not just talking about pro-choice issues, but the way we treat each other everywhere, prisoners in the schools, whatever it may be. Peace through strength. I believe in a strong military. I would change the structure of it, but basically peace through strength. And then lastly, rule of law. Each branch should adhere to the Constitution, and the judicial branch should not be able to exercise legislative or executive powers.
Okay, so that's a discrete set of values. Ed, what about you?
I would identify as blue or Democrat, although I resonate with what Dave said with regard to identity. I don't want to identify as relating specifically to the Democratic Party. At this point in the United States, though, the Democratic Party provides the best lens of moral reasoning that at least best fits my worldview. Justice is not only an important consideration, but justice as fairness or equity or equality, opportunity, representation, I think are essential. I believe it's a must, really, if we're to form a community where all persons are secure and have enough resources to provide housing, clothing, and food for themselves and their families. That's very broad, I know, but I believe policies regulating the commanding heights of the economy, those major sectors like utilities, transportation, natural resources, foreign and domestic trade, those policies must make sure there's enough for all people, while I suppose making room for the creative ambition provided by market economics, as Dave referenced. I guess if I were to think about my values and priorities, fairness is my driving value. a successful businessman raising money for the Boy Scouts, told me a story years ago of going to a friend to raise money for the Boy Scouts. And the friend said, "I'm not giving money to anybody. If people want money, they can go out and make it like I did." That reveals a misunderstanding, or at least that he didn't appreciate the fact that public money pays for roads, the government infrastructure, workforce education, and law and order that made it possible for him to become wealthy. So if market economics could be regulated, I suppose, to ensure equal access in a broad way to market economy, I could champion that. But as trickle-down economics, I've seen more economic evaporation, I think, from working people. In addition, policy, I think, must find a way to care for those who cannot participate in the economy. I have a friend who's a quadriplegic. He adds enormous value to our community, but not economic value. And without public support, I fear he and his family might not escape poverty.
Well, thank you. And it's so interesting. I heard actually a lot of overlap between the things that you all shared. I want to pivot a little bit to a problem that is very widespread in our public discourse, and that is that we have stereotypes about reds and blues. And I as Dave was talking about identities, you know, political identity can be one. And when we just see people as a Republican or a Democrat and not see the person behind that descriptor, we are also dehumanizing them. So I wonder if each of you could identify a prevalent stereotype about your own side, so something that people say about people who identify as you do politically, and explain why that's a harmful stereotype, and then is there a kernel of truth in it?
I think there's a perception that Republicans won't vote for women or minorities because of bigotry. Jen Psaki recently said that Kamala Harris would be an excellent choice for the presidency, but that Republicans were far too sexist and racist to vote for her. She didn't give any consideration to worldviews or issues. She just saw it as a bigotry issue. But Republicans absolutely love Candace Owens, Tulsi Gabbard, Condoleezza Rice, Tim Scott, and frankly, any other woman or minority that would promote their worldviews. So is there a kernel of truth to it? Yes, because there are racist and there are sexist Republicans. They're just not the majority of the party, and I don't think that they really speak for the party.
Okay, and I see how that would be hurtful for people to stigmatize you as a racist or a sexist just because you tend to vote red. Yeah. So thanks for sharing that. Ed, what about you? What's a stereotype of blues?
And I know Dave is not that person.
I know that too.
I know him
well. I think of the Virginia governor, Ralph Northam, was condemned some years ago saying that unwanted babies should be left comfortably to die, and a lot was made of that. But he was actually referring to babies born to die who couldn't survive outside the womb. And so I think sometimes Democrats are accused of not caring about life, not caring about life of the unborn or even at the end of life. And I think that's unfair. Perhaps some Democrats would withhold care. I don't know. I haven't known those stories. But I suppose the kernel of truth is that Democrats in general support an absolute right to the mother to determine the fate of a pregnancy. And one could infer, I suppose, a tolerance in that for a late-term abortion. But the other, I think, is that Democrats are willing to drift toward communism. And that's an interesting thought to me in consideration. I think Democrats as well as Republicans have pretty much embraced Reagan's neoliberal economic ideology of trickle-down economics. And left-of-center Democrats are more open to democratic socialism as a way to level the economic playing field in the market economy, I'm sure. But I don't think this is a drift toward communism. The U.S. has allies who are very strong on social democratic economies or have social democratic economies. And two, I find it interesting that conservative economists like Orrin Cass have proposed economic models that include room for labor unions. So they're kind of carving away some of the rough edges of this neoliberal trickle-down economics, market economy ideas that both parties, I think, have embraced over the last 40 years.
So I hear what both of you are saying is that these are stereotypes are kind of shorthand and don't really take into account the more complex reality behind those labels.
Correct.
I'm Carolyn DuPont, host of the Eastern Standard Series, I'm Polarized, You're Polarized, The Way to a Shared American Future. Our guests today are David Burt, providing a Republican perspective, and Ed Bryson, representing a Democratic point of view. So why are the values and policies that you champion good for the country? Dave, you want to start with that?
Sure. Well, one of mine was personal responsibility and accountability. And I think if you couple that with a merit-based system of hiring and promoting people, I think that is going to extend and increase our excellence. And I think that's important. I think that if you look at the other side of that, which is DEI initiatives, I think those would serve to decrease excellence. A strong military, properly governed, by the way. You can't just have one that's running willy-nilly around. But a strong military, properly governed, will promote peace. I think next that valuing life is just the right thing to do, as I see it. And I think it can result in a higher standard of life for everybody. A market economy produces more, cheaper, and better goods. Pretty much enough said there. You know, we still have poverty in market economies, but not the kind of grinding, crushing poverty that you see in some of these other nations that don't have market economies.
Okay, thank you. And Ed, what about you? What are the values and policies that you embrace good for the country?
Citigroup, from a study in September 2020, reported that systemic racism, and that would have to be broken out, I think, as data to get past the resistance to that phrase. Over the last 20 years, systemic racism, according to this report, has cost the U.S. economy $16 trillion. The U.S. is far behind other developed nations in health care outcomes, though we pay more for health care than anybody else in the world. Education outcomes, unemployment, wages, and the list is long. But we lead in the rate of incarceration and in military spending as much. And I heard Dave say we need a strong military, but, you know, just how do we think about this? Our military spending is equal to the next 26 peer nations combined, 25 of which are allies. So I think we have to think about that. And yet military spending is sacrosanct. We don't want to think about that. It's important to recognize this, I think, is not the fault of Republicans. Both parties, I believe, have promoted destabilizing policies in all these areas. And these policy issues represent real problems that will require both parties to work together for solutions. And finally, I believe many of these problems are rooted in economic policy. I do not have confidence in neoliberal market economics to find solution, but rather only leaders of goodwill can solve real problems.
Thank you for that. I wonder if we could pivot to a question that each of you might want to ask the other, a question of understanding. So, you know, we're masters of the gotcha question in today's society. But what's something about people who think like Ed, David, that you'd really like to understand? And same to you, Ed, what's something about a person who embraces a conservative ideology that that you think you would like to understand better. So I want to give each of you an opportunity to ask a question along those lines. So, Dave, go ahead.
Sure. Ed, I think that we both agree that racism is a plague that we'd like to find a way to exterminate. So what do you believe would be the most effective means that we could take to reduce racism and improve race relations in general in America?
Boy, that's a great question and well asked, I think. I'm annoyed by neighborhoods with speed bumps that bounce me at any speed. And I think, you know, people should respond to speed zones in neighborhoods where children are likely to be playing, or at least respond to the signs erected by parents begging them to slow down. But that should doesn't always fix the problem, the speed bumps. I think merit-based initiatives are most ideal in principle, but DEI initiatives are the speed bumps that attempt, I think, to correct the reality on the ground. So people of color, those from impoverished communities lacking educational opportunity equal to their aptitude, for instance, et cetera, need corrective opportunity until a flat, merit-based culture becomes the norm, I think. It is interesting to me that in the current national race for presidency, two candidates, both with cultural disadvantage, both with high aptitudes, one Democrat and one Republican, might be considered to have benefited from DEI.
Thank you for that complicated answer, Ed. And I also just love how often you couch what you say in I think, because I think one of the things that we're learning is that answers to real problems are difficult, and that grasping the dimensions of the problem sometimes is the first step.
Yeah, difficult, and I don't know very much.
Yes. Well, I love that. None of us really knows very much, even though we often pretend that we do. Ed, you've got a question of understanding that you want to ask Dave.
The temptation, Dave, is to ask about extreme ideology being argued about in the Republican Party, and there's an extreme faction in the Democratic Party as well, I think. But to seek understanding at the heart of the Republican Party, I'd like to better understand how the idea of conservative is more likely to establish a more just and fair society, a society for the common good, than the idea of progressive.
Well, I think that members of both parties want those things, and I think that the conservative position would be that a rising tide lifts all boats, and I think that we get to where we want to be through a very vibrant and powerful economy, while at the same time lifting up those that need help, those that are left behind. I think it's another myth to think that Republicans don't want to help people who are really in need. We do, or I do, or conservatives do. Maybe all don't, but I think most do. I mean, you look at the United States of America. We have our problems, but we have a very high standard of living. And the people who are poor in the United States have a better existence than people who are poor in Venezuela or India or pick your country. So the short answer is create a vibrant and strong economy.
Thank you both. So I'm just curious how this conversation leaves you feeling and thinking about one another. So often these conversations end with hard feelings and a feeling of misunderstanding. And I'm just curious what you're taking away in terms of how this conversation makes you perceive one another.
Well, you know, Ed and I have a ton of commonalities in these things. We want the same thing for America. We both want peace, prosperity, fairness, great schools, little to no gastrointestinal disease. You know, we'll disagree some on the best way to pursue these things, but at the end of the day, I know that Ed has a heart the size of Montana, and I love him for that.
Yeah, thanks. Ed, what about you?
Well, Dave reminds me of so many of my friends who are are thoughtful and smart, and they've thought about these issues. They recognize that as a nation, we have problems that desperately need to be solved. And of course, there are ideological camps out there who honestly look at those problems and try to form policies to address them and solve those problems. Now, obviously, there are some who aren't interested in that so much as in maybe political power, however you want to identify that. But for the most part, I find that so many of my friends and people I respect, like Dave, in the end, they want what I want. They want problems solved, and they want good for the common good. And they recognize that there are people who don't fit, for instance, a merit-based, a flat merit-based ideology or expectation or principle. They recognize that. And they know that we have to make room for those people. So, yeah, I hear that in what Dave has said here today, and I recognize it in him when I see him other places, too, and I appreciate that very much.
Well, I think this has been a brave and beautiful conversation, and I just appreciate both of you for being willing to put yourselves out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Coming up after the break.
It's really important to make sure that kids have the stability of family in their lives.
Plus, what happens when teachers get a pay raise and the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster? I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, November 21st, the Ed Davis Learning Center in Georgetown will host Kentucky Chautauqua, William Wells Brown, How I Got My Name. The show will begin at 3:15 p.m. On Wednesday, December 4th, the Woodford County Women's Club will sponsor Kentucky Chautauqua, Madame Mantel, Educating Young Women. This show will be held in the meeting room of the Pisgah Presbyterian Church and will begin at 11 a.m. And on Sunday, December 8th, the Red River Historical Society in Clay City will sponsor Kentucky Chautauqua, Jemima Boone Calloway, Life on the Frontier. This show will take place at the Meadow Green Appalachian Music Park and will start at 1:30 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
55,000, bigger than the entire populations of Covington, Georgetown, or Richmond, and double the populations of Frankfort, Henderson, and Paducah. That many Kentucky kids are separated from their moms and dads and are being raised by a relative or a close family friend known as kinship or fictive kin caregivers. According to a report from Kentucky Youth Advocates, Kentucky's known prevalence of kinship care is 6%, twice the national average. Shannon Moody is Chief Policy and Strategy Officer at Kentucky Youth Advocates, and she's with us now to dig into that report, Kinship Across Kentucky, Recommendations from Caregiver Voices in 2024. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Shannon.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So in the introduction, I touched on the proportion of Kentucky kids who are not living at home, double the national average. Tell us more about that, about the extent of this life-altering experience for so many Kentucky children.
Yeah, Tom. So what we see in Kentucky and really across the nation are children who end up living in homes away from their parents for a number of reasons, death, incarceration, sometimes military deployments, and then parents not really having the capacity to parent due to significant mental health issues, as well as issues of abuse and neglect that are often stemming from, you know, substance use disorder or substance abuse, as well as domestic violence or other issues and stressors that can create that environment where children are unsafe.
So many of these children, some 55,000 here in Kentucky, are living in the care of a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or maybe older siblings. Is that the situation?
Yeah, that's right. Like you said, Kentucky's rate of kinship care is definitely higher, almost double the national average. And we have what we call fictive kin as well, which are adults that are often known to the child or the family and have an emotionally significant relationship with the child.
Are these kids formally placed in this kinship care, or are many of these arrangements informal?
Many of the arrangements are informal. They don't have Child Protective Services involvement. And what we know is that a lot of times the family members, grandparents, aunts, uncles, siblings, they're just stepping into a gap that they see as a need to help support a child, or often siblings, groups of children, to make sure that they are well and being taken care of.
The report points out that while children in kinship care show more positive behavioral and mental health outcomes, non-kinship foster and adoptive families may have better access to resources and support. Tell us more about that discrepancy.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, our child welfare system was initially set up in a way to support some more formal placements like foster care. And thankfully, we do have the option of foster care that allows for things like a daily monetary stipend, help with clothing supports, help with transportation, and things of that nature that are connected to foster care. And our kinship care system is just less resourced. I do see that changing, and we do know that the Cabinet for Health and Family Services is increasing the amount of resources and supports for kinship families, but it's been a slow transition. And especially for those families who are not connected to the child welfare system or child protective services, those supports and resources are just not out there. They're not typically offered by our, you know, nonprofit and service organizations across the state, because sometimes it feels like this population is just not as present in the minds of service providers, or not as visible sometimes.
In the meantime, do we have enough foster homes in Kentucky?
Unfortunately, we do not have enough foster homes. And while placing a child or children with a relative in foster care is a great option, we also know that that's not always possible for relative caregivers. What we have seen, unfortunately, is a decrease in the overall number of licensed foster homes in the state. And we know that we need more homes for children, especially for those who are a little bit older, 8, 9, 10. We struggle to really find foster homes for kids who are over those ages. And then especially kids who have autism or other developmental or intellectual disabilities, we definitely need homes, more foster homes for teens and youth of color and kids who identify as LGBTQ. So there are foster homes out there. We just don't have quite as many as we need for especially those more vulnerable kids.
Well, what are the social and economic implications of there being so many children growing up in these circumstances?
Yeah, Tom. So we know that kids who experience adversity in their childhood, whether it's being disconnected from a parent, whether it's facing abuse and neglect, that those have lifetime implications, especially if a child does not get the needed supports. So think about every system that a child and their caregivers, whether it's foster parents or kinship caregivers, interact with, the education system, the need for mental health services. We know that there is an impact overall, both on the economic aspects of that and what is provided through the state within those supportive systems like mental health care through Medicaid or within the child welfare system. You know, obviously there's staffing needs, there's case management needs there. So a lot of that comes with a price tag. And we also know that, unfortunately, children who are living with caregivers other than their birth parents are going to struggle with education, with potentially juvenile justice system involvement. So it's really important to make sure that kids have the stability of family in their lives and also are getting some of those extra supports that are needed if they do address or face an adversity or traumatic event during their childhood.
Senate Bill 151, also known as the Kinship Bill, it was passed by the General Assembly, signed by the governor, Governor Beshear, and was supposed to take effect in mid-July. But did it? Was it funded?
So there seems to be some debate around that, Tom. Is there funding that is included in the budget for kinship care that would typically cover the costs of what the legislation changes? I do believe there is. Was there a specific line item on the budget specifically for Senate Bill 151 in this most recently developed budget? There was not. And there are federal funding streams that should be tapped. However, it would often necessitate a family to elect to be foster parents immediately following placement rather than take temporary custody and have that 120 days to elect to be foster parents as written in the bill. We know that kinship caregivers really need that time to make the decisions. But what we also know is that there are funding restrictions based on the federal level and what we can pull down, as well as what was or was not included in the budget this session.
Well, what do you think about that? Are we looking at some of the partisan politics that we've become all too familiar with these days, or is this more kind of down to legislative incompetence?
You know, I do believe that everyone involved is interested in ensuring that kinship families are adequately resourced. But I also worry that our kinship families are kind of getting lost in the shuffle of potentially partisan politics. There were 19 other bills this session that were caught up in this issue as well around funding. So is it a partisan issue? You know, I can't be sure, but I do believe it's in the best interest of our Kentucky families and kids to resolve this issue sooner rather than later, and ideally leave the politics out of it.
Is there any movement toward that, toward resolving it?
Based on what I understand, there are some conversations that are ongoing. But as of right now, I'm not aware of any resolution. It seems like there are some pretty clear ideas on what needs to happen. And I assume it will require legislative action, unless for some reason the Cabinet for Health and Family Services is able to create some practices or regulation changes in the immediate to allow for those kinship families to have some more time to make an informed decision. But what I'm hearing right now is it's still not being implemented.
Well, in the meantime, I'm thinking of people who might be listening to us right now who are going through this, and they've just learned that they're going to be taking in a grandchild or a niece or a nephew or a younger brother or sister. What can they do? What is available to help them?
So there are a couple of options for families who are stepping up to take care of kiddos. They should reach out to the Kinship Families Coalition of Kentucky. We have resources on the website there. There's also a group out of University of Kentucky called KY Kins. They provide support groups and other options for both financial and intangible supports. And then if there is Child Protective Services involvement, making sure that they're talking to their caseworker, asking their caseworker about those options, as well as calling the relative kinship care hotline, which is posted on the DCBS website. And I can also provide the number for that as well.
Okay.
The kinship support hotline can be contacted at 877-565-5608. Or folks can email relative.supports@ky.gov if they have questions and they have some involvement with the Department for Community-Based Services. Or even if they don't, I would recommend that they reach out to seek out other options and support.
Okay. And we've only skimmed the surface of this report. There's a lot of depth there, a lot of information. If somebody wants to dig into it further and would like to even download it, where can they go for that?
Yes, they can go to Kentucky Youth Advocates website at kyyouth.org. And the report is still on the front page there. They also have, we have a tab that has our publications and it's listed on our publications. So we'd encourage anyone to go check that out.
That's Shannon Moody, Chief Policy and Strategy Officer at Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks so much, Shannon.
Thanks for your time, Tom.
Nothing like a pay raise to feel appreciated. Education contributor Gil Hunter looks into what happened when a Kentucky school district made that move.
Catherine Goode is an English teacher at Taylor County High School. Catherine graduated from Eastern Kentucky University with a degree in English teaching in December 2015 and has been a high school English teacher since then, earning her master's degree in English from Morehead State University and her National Board certification as well. She lives in her hometown of Campbellsville, Kentucky, with her husband and two sons. She recently shared on Facebook news of Taylor County's impressive pay raises and other incentives for employees throughout the school district, which is what we're going to talk about today. Catherine, it's great to hear your voice and talk with you.
It's nice to talk with you, too. I'm glad you reached out.
Absolutely. So this summer, several school districts in Kentucky announced pay raises. Taylor County was one of those. Also, increased benefits for teachers and staff. You said you've been at Taylor County for 7 years, and it looks like they were especially bold with the pay raises for teachers, staff, and even bus drivers as well. So what was your reaction when you heard the news?
I was really excited to see the raises this year. My department, the English department, has a group chat, and you can imagine that the reaction when we saw the news was just overwhelmingly positive. We've gotten cost of living raises in the past, but this one felt very, very significant.
Oh, I'd say so. Yeah, a lot of school districts are giving raises for cost of living and things like that. But I think I saw Taylor County, 7% pay raise for staff, 8 to 12% for teachers, and 20% for bus drivers. So it feels like an aggressive action on their part. Recruiting employees, I guess, retaining employees. You went to Taylor County High School, is that right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and so what's the culture of the place? Is there a need for this kind of recruitment and retention initiatives? A lot of places are having trouble recruiting teachers. What's the atmosphere like?
There are a lot of school districts in the area, and it seems like everybody is hiring for a lot of positions. I feel like these raises do help us stay competitive, help us recruit, help us retain. I really love where I work. We have a great team and a really strong community. But realistically, if you're a new teacher and you're looking for a place to be, you're going to go where the better salary is.
Sure, sure. So go back to that group chat you mentioned then. Is there optimism among your colleagues that the pay raises are going to help help the school get teachers, help the school keep teachers, help the district do the same?
Yes, definitely optimism and enthusiasm.
Yeah, good. So I'm also, sure that the raise is going to help you and your family. Have you thought about what that difference is going to be like? Maybe you're like me and my family. When we get a raise, we plan to spend it three times over already. So have you made those plans?
Yes, it's definitely easy to spend money. The raise doesn't technically start until August, but one goal that my husband and I have been working towards was getting a new minivan. We're minivan people now, so we went ahead and made that purchase this summer.
Ah, good. Yeah, definitely optimistic purchase. I like that. Any other plans for the raise?
With inflation, I'm sure it'll come in handy at the grocery store, help offset some of those costs.
Sure, sure. So the raise isn't the only benefit that Taylor County introduced, though. There were some other improved benefits or new benefits. So what else is changing this year?
In addition to the raises, our school board is offering paid maternity leave for teachers and staff members and an in-house childcare option for employees' children ages 1 through 3.
Wow. So paid maternity leave, that's a change. That's new, huh?
Yes. So that's in addition to, I guess, FMLA. I don't know technically how all of those details are going to work yet, but I assume it's something like not having to use your sick days.
Okay. And so the in-house childcare, that's an interesting detail too. I've heard about some other districts doing that. Is that something that that maybe members in that group chat are particularly excited about?
Yes. So they're calling it the Nest, which I think is adorable because our mascot is a cardinal.
Ah.
So the Nest is going to be a certified daycare. It's going to be on our main campus, and it's only going to cost $125 per week for district employees. I know several coworkers who are excited about both of these benefits, the maternity leave and the daycare. But I know that another daycare facility in town recently closed, and a lot of teachers used that daycare facility. So this relieves a lot of stress for them.
Okay. So you have boys. Is this the kind of thing that you'd be making use of?
My kids are 4 and 6, so they're a little bit too old for the daycare. Going to be in school in first grade next year.
Okay.
But if we decide to add to our family in the future, it's definitely nice to know that those benefits are available.
Sure, sure. Makes perfect sense. Yeah. So finally, Catherine, before I let you go, I'm remembering that you were in my English teaching methods class, and that was way back when, fall of 2014, I think now, which seems like such a long time ago. But I remember you as such a smart and smart student, and you did such good work. And I know that you have to be the same kind of teacher. I know Taylor County is happy to have you. And it seems like that group chat has some energy behind it, and you may have a voice there in Taylor County. So my question that I want to end with is, if Taylor County administrators, if members of the Taylor County School Board are listening, then what else do they need to know? What's the next difference-making step they should take, in your opinion?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I have to thank you first, because if I'm a good teacher, it's definitely you had a huge hand in that, as a professor and as an advisor and as a thesis mentor during undergraduate. I tell Dr. Hunter stories all the time, so... I'm very appreciative of you.
Well, thank you for that.
But also, if there are any Taylor County administrators or board members listening, I would like to thank them as well. I think this raise is a testament to all of the good work that they try to do in our community and that they do in our community. You know, they are very in tune with what the needs are of the children and what people need. And, you know, one way to invest in the community is to invest in their teachers and staff. And they definitely make strong efforts to do that as well.
Yeah, I love that you make that connection between investment in students and investment in teachers and staff. So I'll ask that question again, though. Anything else you've got their ear? Anything else they should be thinking about that that needs to happen?
You know, just keep listening. And they do a good job of that at board meetings and, you know, on social media. But just keep listening to what people need and do their best to meet those needs.
Yeah, good. Thank you so much. So I've been talking with Catherine Good today, an English teacher at Taylor County High School, about the pay raise and other benefits that she and her colleagues will receive this year in Taylor County schools. Catherine, it's really great to hear your voice. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. This is Gil Hunter for Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Raymond Thompson, an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas, has been exploring the experience of African-American events, events that are there, they happen, but very little of the details are widely known. One of those events occurred in 1930s Summersville, West Virginia. The construction of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel, and what some refer to as the worst industrial disaster in U.S. history. Raymond has captured the story in a mix of photos, prose, and poetry for the book Appalachian Ghost, a photographic reimagining of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster. And he joins us from Austin to talk about it. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Raymond, one reviewer that I've read has written that in Appalachian Ghost, each image or artifact connects Hawk's Nest to the disgrace and the dehumanization of racism. What's the story of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster?
In the 1930s, roughly 5,000 workers sort of descended on Anside, West Virginia, to build a powerhouse and a dam to divert the New River as the source of power to power a factory that was downriver, a metal factory. And while they were doing this digging through the mountain, they ran across a portion of silica rock. And because they were using improper drilling techniques, when you dry drill into silica rock, it kicks up dust and kicks up silica dust. And when you breathe that in, it will destroy your lungs. Some people were affected immediately, and some people took a few months or years to feel the full effects.
And that happened in pretty large numbers, right?
Yeah, it was, the numbers were sort of like, if you go into the history books and you look, there's all kinds of numbers. The company Union Carbide had listed the number. I believe it was somewhere just over 100.
Yeah, something like 129, I believe. But it was actually much, much more than that.
Yeah. But of course, there's a demographer who's putting together the death rates at the time of the space and came up with a number that was in the upper 700s. And that's sort of the number that I've used in my research to show on people who passed away. But of course, if you look at the 5,000 workers and maybe 3,000 of those workers were actually working underground, that's a very, very high death rate for a construction project.
How has this situation, which referred to as the Hawk's Nest disaster, how's that been historically mis- or underrepresented?
Well, the first thing is just simply if you go to these landscapes now and look around, you'll see very almost nothing in the landscape that points that something of this scale happened in the space. There's a couple of signs at very specific points that talk about what happened in Hawk's Nest, but these signs are relatively new. And I was always really struck by when I asked people who are from these areas or from these locations or from West Virginia that they knew almost nothing about the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster. So overall, just this general like absence of understanding of what happened in this space. But also at the same time, when you do research and you look into what happened at this space, it's really interesting how who is the voice of this project. Oftentimes, out of the 5,000 workers, roughly two-thirds of those people were African-Americans. I'm always struck when I go to look for stories about what happened in this space. I'm often finding white voices who are telling the story.
Mm-hmm. The statistical data that relates to this story is kind of all over the map. How were you able to pin down how extensive this disaster actually was compared to what appears on those plaques and so forth that you referred to?
There was one demographer who wrote this whole book that had all the data and numbers that I was the major source for my understanding and also for other people who have written about it, understanding of the numbers in space. So he is basically a well-researched facts that I pulled from to draw off of. Using his work, I was able to gather information and to have some sort of firm number foundation to stand on or number to point at to know how many people who passed away in the space.
So how did this story and the situation come to your attention? You're in Texas. It happened in West Virginia.
Well, at the time I was in West Virginia. I was living in West Virginia. I was there for 9 years working at West Virginia University. And while I was working there, I was working for university relations. We often would get books from the press, West Virginia University Press. And one time my coworker brought me a copy of the Book of the Dead by Merle Rukeyser with this really beautiful introduction by Catherine Venerable Moore. And it was that book and that introduction that really kind of piqued my interest about Hawk's Nest Tunnel. I loved the book because it really helped me begin to visualize in my head what this space would look like. And I, of course, had never been down to Fayetteville or Anstead, West Virginia to see these places. But the poetry that Merle Rukeyser wrote combined with Catherine's essay was very, very visceral and really, really piqued my interest to want to at least start thinking about it some more. And that was roughly, I think, maybe a year or two passed before reading that book and actually going down the Hawk's Nest and having that first initial experience that really helped me jump into the story.
Well, I know that you've done photojournalism for the New York Times, for NPR, for that matter. How did you go about producing the imagery that listeners are going to see when they pick up a copy and open the pages?
Yeah, so it's tough, right? Because the book is a combination of a lot of different types of materials. One of it is the visual archive that surrounds Hawk's Nest, and all that material I found down at the West Virginia State Archives. So I had that archive. I had old newspaper clipping archives. I had letters that are written by workers to talking about their experience in the archive. And then I had my own images that I made to go with the work. And those images were usually recreations or reenactments of sort of me using the visual evidence I can find in the visual archive and sort of fleshing that out by creating these images that really, really focus on this idea of dust, this dust moving through the air, the silicose dust moving. And the images that you're going to see when you open a book will be these recreations, these bodies surrounded by these clouds of dust, these bodies covered in dust. But also you'll see images that are from the archive, or either like the direct archival image itself, or there are a couple images in which I've gone into the archive and I've cut out individuals and bought them out of the archive that let them have their own space on the page to look at. I also use a lot of maps, maps of the area, maps of space, all to sort of flesh out this story of what happened in this location.
And speaking of that, it's not just photographs, is it? There's prose, there's poetry to convey and to advance the story.
Yes, there is an essay. There's like three essays total. Like one is sort of Catherine was kind enough to write an introduction. I wrote sort of my experience of the space through an essay as well. There's a poem that I wrote, that there's a concluding essay that wraps up, that connects Hawk's Nest to the larger issue of extraction within Appalachia.
Can you give us a sampling of perhaps the poetry?
All right. The poem is called Dust and Power. Lovers and friends stand high above the dam at the bend of the New River. Why are you here? Do they know? No one stops to look at the marker. Hundreds killed, mostly black. Single word phrases, the walk. What does it mean to me? I come to this place in search of ghosts. How should we remember you? How should we remember you? How should we remember you? History says you never had a chance, as victim or hero. Did you fall to the arms of capital or of race? Historical amnesia descends on the country, state, nation. A marker to your sacrifice, the phenomenological writing, the company statement, the entrance to the Hawk's Nest overlook. What are we willing to give up in the name of money? A monument of misrepresentation. Why can't we remember you?
All right. That's Raymond Thompson, author of Appalachian Ghost, A Photographic Reimagining of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel Disaster. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you so much, Raymond.
Thank you.
Raymond Thompson is a finalist for the National Indie Excellence Award in Photography for the book Appalachian Ghost, A Photographic Reimagining of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel Disaster. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at eswEKU.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And remember, as John Lennon said, everything will be okay in the end, and if it's not okay, it's not the end. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.